computers online. I'm driving 44K.
T-minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T-minus 25 seconds. T-minus 20 seconds.
All lines are go.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here are your hosts, Anita Langley and Leno Sanek.
Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you are around the world. This is Leno Sanek for Black Op Radio, show number 251. I'm joined in the control room with Anita Langley.
Hello.
Good to see you again, Anita.
Yeah. And I do understand, hopefully with everything clicking together, that we have Professor Donald Scott on the line.
Yes, indeed.
Great. You can hear us okay?
Yes, I can.
Well, Professor Scott, is once again a privilege to have you on. We've had you on, I think, on two other occasions on Black Op Radio. But we're always impressed with the Journal of Degenerative Diseases that you offer. I can't promote that enough to people. Of course, I have information on how to order that on the previous interviews, but I'll add that again today. In the meantime, do you have a new website at all? Before, you never didn't have a website.
No, we still don't. We do all our research from hard research data. And by the way, I can hear an echo as I speak. Can we get rid of that?
I don't hear it at this end.
Okay. I get it here. But no, we don't have a website, and all our research is, as I say, the hard copy research data, scientific documents, and so on. And any correspondence we encourage to be by mail or telephone.
Okay, well, we'll put your address on how to get the good work you've been doing. Of course, sir, from plants to animals to us. The life, I think just the title was Life, is fantastic, and I'm still not completely all the way through it. I pick it up in bits and pieces. But, look, before we get into your latest, that journal there, we just have a proof copy of your latest journal out there, and I'm not sure what volume it is.
Yes, it's volume 6, numbers 1 and 2.
Right, volume 6. Well, we're going to be talking about that a little later, but earlier, when we spoke on the phone just about arranging the interview here, I was unaware that you were friends with Jim Garrison, and of course, since the JFK assassination, the anniversary was just November 22nd, a little while ago, we, Black Op Radio, tend to do shows regarding political conspiracies, wherever they lead, and JFK assassination was one that really had a lot of common interest.
Yes.
So I think when people investigate that one, they find the reasons why so many people are skeptical and find governments acting against their best behalf, because they can look into this one case and find, like they said in the movie, black is white and white is black now.
Right.
When they had the Warren Commission, the Warren Report, and even the evidence that they had, the evidence they omitted was enormous, but what they had did not support the conclusion. So when you told me that you had known Jim Garrison and you went down to New Orleans, I was very interested, and I thought, well, we'll just keep this for the show. So if you can, why don't you give me a brief background to that on what got you connected with your interest in the JFK assassination?
Okay. My interest began, actually, during the Watergate. Shortly after the Watergate hearings and all that had been completed, my son bought me a copy of the Nixon Watergate or Nixon tapes. And on the, one of the tapes, we heard Nixon saying that they would pay $1 million to keep Howard Hunt quiet because he could spill a lot of beans about the Bay of Pigs thing. And it was only after that we learned that whenever Nixon talked about the Kennedy assassination, he referred to it as the Bay of Pigs thing. For some weird reason, that's just the way Nixon's mind worked. So here he was, prepared to pay Hunt $1 million, if necessary, to keep quiet about the Kennedy assassination. And I wondered why would he be so interested in the Kennedy assassination? Nobody had ever accused him of doing it or being involved. So I went back to the Kennedy assassination and began my research into it. And when I do research, as I mentioned, I like to go to primary sources, initial sources. So I looked up, among others, Carrie Thornley, who was a friend of Lee Harvey Oswald's in the Marines. I looked up Beverly Oliver, who was in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd.
And, Donald?
Yes.
Yeah, we seem to be losing you a little bit. Can you speak up just a bit? Would you like us to maybe just stop and call you back? Maybe we have a bad connection.
Could you do that? Because that echo is very upsetting.
Sure. Sorry about that. We'll, I'll call you right back in 10 seconds.
Thank you.
Okay. There.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, we have a better connection. So you were mentioning that you had decided to search out Beverly Oliver, Carrie Thornley. You were just mentioning their names as we...
Yes, and I organized a seminar for Sudbury and invited Marina Oswald to come up from Dallas, Fort Worth, and she very courteously agreed. And
so that's Sudbury's in Ontario, Canada, for those
yes,
who don't
indeed.
Know.
Yes, indeed. And we
and
had
what year
Marina
was that?
Oswald here.
Sorry.
Pardon?
Sorry, what year was that?
Oh, gosh, what, that was 1993.
Oh, okay.
We had, as I say, Marina Oswald here and a number of others who had first-hand knowledge of many details of the assassination. And at one point, I dropped a line to Jim Garrison, and I was surprised within a matter of just a few days, I got a reply from him, and he answered the questions I'd asked him very politely, and I phoned him and thanked him, and he was very courteous on the phone, and we chatted on the phone a few times and exchanged a number of letters, clearing up certain points that had arisen, and then I arranged to go down to New Orleans to visit with him, and I did that. And had some very enjoyable chats with the gentleman. He was such a nice guy. He was about 6 foot 7 inches tall, and he wore a size 14 shoe, and he was inclined to sit at his desk with his feet up on the desk, these great big shoes blocking him out of view quite often. And he was very candid, very straightforward about the whole thing, had a wonderful sense of humor. Even though the thing was, the subject matter was also very tragic, he saw it in perspective. He knew that there are evil people, and he knew that we're in a kind of a great contest with evil people, and he saw the dark humor of so much of what went on, and we exchanged a number of points of view, and when that particular meeting was over, he went to his filing cabinet, and he took out a document, and he said, "Here you go." He said, "This is the speech I gave to the jury that tried me when they arrested me for fraud." He said, "When they were trying to shut me down, they tried to do everything but kill me physically." And he said, "I was arrested, as you know, and I defended myself in court." And he handed me his document, which was his closing speech to the jury. And the jury, of course, found him innocent of all charges. But very, very fascinating to me was the revelation that the major guy that the government used as a witness against Garrison was a person by the name of Pershing Gervais. Now, Pershing was a really strange character. You may know him from other sources, but anyway, he had testified that he had participated with Jim Garrison in collecting money from people who had slot machines, illegal slot machines, and that sort of thing. And he gave all this testimony. And then when Garrison was found to be innocent of all charges, Pershing Gervais disappeared from New Orleans. And nobody saw him for, a year and a half, 2 years. And then one day, a reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune newspaper was walking along a street in Vancouver, British Columbia. And lo and behold, who comes walking down the street towards her but Pershing Gervais? And so this reporter said to Pershing, she said, "Pershing Gervais, what are you doing here?" And Pershing recognized her as a reporter for the Times-Picayune because she had covered the trial and interviewed him numerous times. And he said, "Oh, my goodness," he said, "I didn't think I'd meet anybody from New Orleans here. Please, don't say anything about my being here." And she said, "Well, I'm a reporter," she said. I've got to report encountering you." He said, "Oh, no, don't. She said, "Why not?" And he said, "Well, I'm here by a special arrangement between the United States government, the Canadian government, and General Motors." He said, "All I do is go down every Friday to a General Motor dealership," and I think it's on record which one it is. I don't have it here. And he said, "I pick up my check." And he said, "I and my wife and my children all have Canadian birth certificates. We all have British Columbia health plan certificates. We all have, or my wife and I have British Columbia driver's licenses." Here was a guy who had participated with the U.S. government in an attempt to blackmail and to blackball Jim Garrison, and as his reward, he got a lifelong sinecure in Vancouver, British Columbia, and the government of Canada cooperating, the police department, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in British Columbia obviously cooperating, and other people in the hierarchy cooperating, but as well, General Motors was paying his check every week. Now, I thought this is really startling evidence demonstrating that the trail that Jim Garrison was following and that I have been following since Watergate is the truth about the assassination of John F. Kennedy. It's not a conspiracy buff's meanderings or imaginings. The reality is that there are power people who can do things to people like Jim Garrison and do it with the cooperation not only of American government and officials and police, but Canadian government and police. And so Pershing was out there in Vancouver, British Columbia, and when the Times-Picayune reporter went back to New Orleans, she filed a story about meeting Pershing Gervais in Vancouver, and Pershing has cover blown. General Motors having a hard time explaining why they were paying him a check every week. And he had to pack up and leave Vancouver and go back to New Orleans. And that's where he last was when I heard last about him.
Wow.
No. But it's just so typical of what is going on in the world. in all of these instances, instances that you might refer to as the great crimes against humanity, whether it's the death of a president who is really a very remarkable reformist president in terms of international relations and the work against the mafia and the work against the, for example, Israel's development of the atom bomb and so on, this power group can order the assassination of a person like that in the middle of the day, in the middle of a huge city, and they can do it without having to face trials and investigations of any meaningful nature. The Warren Commission is a bunch of garbage. It's absolute garbage when you read it and you know what went on. One story that delighted me that Jim Garrison mentioned, and I still find it hilarious. He was talking about the Warren Report and how in one of the books of evidence they had several pages devoted to the fact that Jack Ruby's mother wore false teeth. And Garrison said, this wouldn't even have been relevant had Ruby bitten Oswald to death. And but yeah. That's the Warren Commission. It's baloney. It's absolute junk. And the truth is to be found more in Oliver Stone's JFK than it ever was in the Warren Report.
No, I think it's the tip of the iceberg. And it's also appalling, the real, I can't think of a better word than gutless, but the people like Gary Mack and the Posners who come out and say, I believe Lee Oswald did it, and here's why we should get behind this theory and you know, and back up the Warren Commission. It's gutless. There's no sense of truth and democracy and anything. Now, that's all, you know, very naive, I know, but the idea is if you are going to stick up and vote and have elections and have a justice system, you should have some kind of court that stands up for something. And the longer you play along with it and say, oh, well, we know the other guys did it. We know as soon as they put Alan Dulles in charge of that, that was fixed. But we don't, you know, it's like, and it's not to call Americans any name, but it's like, why hasn't anyone stood up to doubt this? Now, no agency has fought against this. They've all gone along with it. And it's only been concerned citizens that have taken upon this to ask for anything to be done, and of course there never will be a trial, but like Fletcher Prouty used to say, to not have a trial in Dallas was actually illegal.
Yeah.
There's no way they could have a murder in the state of Dallas and not have a trial for it, and even Officer Tippett.
Right.
So if they're not going to have a trial for Lee Oswald, or a trial for John F. Kennedy, or a trial for
Jack Ruby,
or Tippett, then you can see what kind of power is able to stop the normal justice from happening.
Yeah.
And people just have gone along with it, except for concerned citizens. But for people like Gary Mack, you know, no sense name-calling, but is completely opposite to anything that people in a civilization should be looking forward to, such as the idea of justice or the idea of democracy. And especially when America is going over bombing and killing and, you know, doing whatever in the name of democracy, at least you would think they would want to stand up for that at home. But that isn't the case. And even under Bill Clinton, when he had, what's her name there as Attorney General? When they were trying to dig up Janet Reno, facts about the Martin Luther King case, they all dragged their feet. So it doesn't matter about Republican or Democrat. It means something's wrong in the system where wealthy, powerful people, as you say, have got their hands on the pulse of what's going to happen and what they will allow.
Yes.
And that's just the way it works. So you can investigate the John F. Kennedy assassination and just really get a good idea of how the world works, in spite of what you read in the paper.
Very much so. Mm-hmm. And it's the same inability of people, or any significant number of people, to require that they be told the truth, that they hold explanations up to careful examination and require evidence. For example, the John F. Kennedy assassination was a terrible blow to the progress of humankind, as far as my research into he and his...
Yeah, that's a good way of stating it. That's what I was implying.
Yes, indeed. And he was covering so many fronts. He had the Mossad in Israel against him because he said to the president of Israel, look, you have to stop manufacturing an atom bomb. And he said, you've got to compensate displaced Palestinians for their homes and businesses and farms that they have lost. And the Mossad was very, very active in participating in the assassination of the president. The chiefs of staff of the United States military also, Lyman Lemnitzer and a number of others, their role in the assassination, to those who look at all the evidence, is very clear. But the whole lack of demand from the average citizen that they be told the truth, and their refusal to put forth mental energy to examine evidence. For example, as I say, the AIDS epidemic in the world, there is not a shadow of a doubt when you go back to the primary literature, and we have the primary literature all in our files here, there is not a shadow of a doubt but that the AIDS cofactors, the mycoplasma agent which causes a suppression of the human immune system, and a sheep Vizsla retrovirus which invades human cells and takes over their DNA and makes the human cell manufacture more of them, of the virus. This is a clearly biologically engineered arrangement and developed by people who you can see in the literature. You read the literature by people like Robert Huebner and Dr. R.M. Couch down at Baylor University, and Dr. Kaprowski of Wistar Institute. AIDS was invented in the United States of America, was put into smallpox vaccine, and 17 teams of technicians from the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, were sent to Africa and certain other of the third world countries, and with the cooperation of the Portuguese government in the Portuguese colonies and of the Belgian and French governments in Central Africa and of the British government and the Israeli government in South Africa, they vaccinated millions of black and brown people with a vaccine that was laced with mycoplasma and laced with Vizsla virus, which had been passaged through bovine species and so on. And within 5 years of these people accepting these vaccinations, the first cases of AIDS began to present. And now, this very day, 8,000 people a day are dying of AIDS. And we're sitting around here in Canada and the people in the United States and in Europe and so on, sitting here letting 8,000 people a day be murdered by the United States government. There's no shadow of a doubt. And if people challenge me on it, I'll go through the literature with them.
Oh, I know you have a lot of it. I've seen it. But look, I'd like to continue that thought, but just before that, if we could get back to some other things you mentioned about Beverly Oliver and also Carrie Thornley.
Yes. Well, Beverly Oliver, of course, had her film and camera taken and never returned to her, And she's also convinced that Jack Ruby was up behind the fence in the grassy knoll in Dealey Plaza. But Kerry Thornley, he was an associate of Lee Harvey Oswald in the Marine Corps, and he was particularly important to the Warren Commission because he went along with everything the Warren Commission wanted him to say about Oliver being about Oswald being withdrawn, introverted, pouty kind of guy. And all of that went into the Warren Commission. Well, I was able to track down Kerry Thornley. I had to do a fair amount of research and where he was and who knew him and following up in different leads. And I finally tracked him to Atlanta, Georgia. And a book dealer in Atlanta, Georgia, that I talked to on the phone said, "Oh yes, Kerry Thornley." He said, "You pretty well call him now a street person. He's quite often looking around for a place to sleep, and he says he uses the back of my store to bunk sometimes, and I let him do that." And I said, "Well, look, if I write a letter and address it to him, care of you, would you see he gets it?" And he said, "Yes, indeed." Excuse me. So I wrote Kerry Thornley a letter, and I said to him that I had read his testimony in the Warren Commission report, and I said, "Mr. Thornley, you were lying. I said, the way you phrased your sentences and all manner of other pieces of evidence tells any student of the English language that you were obfuscating a lot of the time. And if you ever get the urge to phone or write or whatever to tell somebody objectively what actually went on, because I said this kind of thing happens with people, think of me." And I gave him my address, and I gave enclosed a check for $20 U.S. made out to him, and he cashed the check. And I've got that cash check in my files with his signature on the back. And what surprised me, about 2 weeks later, I got a copy of his diary in the mail, several hundred pages of typescript. And in it, he's meeting E. Howard Hunt and other people who were involved in the Kennedy assassination, and tells about how he had been in the military with Oswald and certain other details. But it's a fascinating document, and it raises a number of questions with me as a student of the assassination of President Kennedy. But I thought it indicated that this guy has some element of morality, you know, hidden away beneath the exterior that he showed at the Warren Commission. And I wrote back to him, and we exchanged letters back and forth, and I told him that he needed to publish not just his diary, but he needed to publish certain other material, and that I'd like to meet with him and investigate the possibilities of doing that. So my wife and I journeyed to Atlanta, Georgia, where on a particular day, I forget the day now, I can check it out, but on that particular day at 12 noon in one of the Ramada Inns in town, we were to meet and discuss the possibilities of him publishing certain things and sharing with me more information and so on, and he never turned up. And he never answered any further of my letters, and it wasn't too many months after that that I saw a brief squib in the local paper that Kerry Thornley, Lee Harvey Oswald's Marine buddy, had been found dead on the street in Atlanta. And so that ended my links with Kerry Thornley, except for the fact that I have here with me now this Carrie Thornley diary, and it tells people, it tells an awful lot about the life of what you might call a foot soldier in the ranks of these people who manipulate others. You can tell from it that he thought he was being used, but he wasn't totally aware that he was being used. And it's a very interesting document.
Well, I'll have to connect on you somehow to do something with that.
Well, what I do now for people who want it is I photocopy the typescript and send it to people, and I have to charge about to photocopy all the pages. It costs about $25 for a full photocopy copy of his diary, Carrie Thornley's diary. And if anybody wants one, well, they can always get in touch with me and send me a check for $25, and I'll go out and photocopy it all and package it up and send it out to them.
Well, that's great, because it's nice. We've got a pretty good record at Black Hawk Radio in the archives of the evidence around the Kennedy case, and that actually is a very important point. If it's somebody who, after the fact, obviously he wanted you to have that for a reason, so what it is almost like a statement that he wants you to understand the behind-the-scenes activities.
Yeah, people who do this, aren't there? You know, like people who are guilty of various crimes or involved in various crimes, and they feel guilty about it. And they're not sure why they feel guilty, because at the time they weren't doing anything they consciously thought of as being illegal. But then when the full picture begins to emerge, they see, hey, yeah, look, I was a party to this whole thing. And I won't go into the kind of evidence I've identified in these writings of his, but there is evidence there for me. And if I wasn't so busy researching the medical challenges of the day, I would certainly have been doing work in that area, but I just don't have the time to do it.
I have to ask you, because you made a lot of references to Tulane University.
Yes.
How much of your Kennedy assassination research crossed paths with your biological research?
Oh, quite a bit. You know, Dr. Alton Ochsner, who was director of the Tulane University Medical College, he was really quite a criminal. It's amazing, but he had a doctor on staff at Tulane University called Dr. Mary Sherman. Now, Dr. Mary Sherman had a very strange friend. His name was David Ferry. Now, Mary Sherman was one of the top figures in cancer research in the United States. She wasn't just some kind of idle-minded woman who takes up with a weird person like David Ferry, who was a friend of Lee Harvey Oswald, as you know. She was a scholar, a significant cancer scholar, and her friend David Ferry, his apartment had a whole bunch of mice, again, in cages along one wall, with very meticulous charts he kept, and those mice had been inoculated with a monkey virus. They had taken a virus from monkeys, and they had grown these viruses on monkey kidneys, and they label the viruses MK, and then there's different numbers for it. And she was working with David Ferry, of all things. Ferry, the friend of Lee Harvey Oswald.
Have you ever encountered a researcher by the name of Ed Haslam?
Oh, yes, yes.
I thought you might have connected because he wrote an excellent book, Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus.
Right on.
And then I saw the connections you were making. It just seemed inevitable that the two of you would have crossed paths.
Yes, well, Mary Sherman, as you know from Ed Haslam's book, died mysteriously. Now, they said she was murdered in her apartment, stabbed to death, and then set on fire. But the thing is, although the bedclothes on her bed were burned, her right arm, I think it was, right up to the shoulder, was burned totally off. There was no bone or anything, and yet the rest of her body was relatively untouched. Now, to have heat sufficient to burn the whole right arm, including the bone, meant that there was tremendous heat there. And why didn't the rest of the bed burn? Why didn't the bedclothes burn? Why didn't the rest of her body burn? Well, the evidence, as Haslam suggests, and it certainly stands very close examination, was that she was probably working with a particle accelerator at Tulane. Now, they were doing a whole lot of weird work with radioactive particles and altering genetic patterns and all the rest of it. And the evidence is she was killed on campus in Tulane. And rather than have Tulane the subject of a big investigation, they hurry her burned, dead body back to her apartment, lay her on her bed, light a few bedclothes on fire, stab her a few times, because the stabbing seemed to have taken place after she died, excuse me, because there wasn't bleeding, and then flee the apartment, and they find her stabbed, burned body, and they say Mary Sherman was murdered by an interloper, and that gets her out of the way. But it just shows, again, the peculiar high-level network that is at work, because one can't overemphasize how significant Mary Sherman was in the world of cancer research. And it brings to mind another case that you may have heard of, Dr. Jose Rivera. Now, Dr. Jose Rivera was a colonel in the Army, and he was also a part-time worker with the National Institutes for Health and with the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta and in Washington, D.C. And sometime about 6 months before the assassination of President Kennedy, Dr. Jose Rivera, excuse me, met a lady in Washington, D.C. at a medical conference. They chummed around together during the conference, and then she told him that she was transferring down to Tulane University in New Orleans. And he said, "Oh, New Orleans, I know it well." He said, "And you're going there?" And she said, "Yes, I am." And he says, "Well, look, here's a phone number." And he took a piece of paper and he wrote a phone number on it. And he said, "Phone this number when you get there and ask for a gentleman called Lee Harvey Oswald." And she said, "All right, I'll phone him and give him your best wishes." She said, no. He said, "We got a private joke." He says, "When he comes to the phone, just say to him that you spoke to me and that I said gave you this message, kill the chief." And she thought it was a peculiar message, but this is before the assassination. She had no concept of President Kennedy being assassinated. So anyway, she gets down to New Orleans. She gets settled in. About a week after she's there, she takes this phone number out and remembers what she said, so she dialed the number, and a guy came to the phone, and she said, "Is Mr. Lee Harvey Oswald there?" And the fellow said, "No, nobody by that name here." And she said, "Are you sure?" And the guy said, "Yeah, nobody by that name here." So she put the number aside and thought, well, maybe Dr. Jose Rivera wrote down the wrong name or the wrong number or whatever, and that was it. Then, after the assassination, before the assassination, she came upon this piece of paper again, thought, well, look, maybe I dialed the wrong number. So she redialed the number that she had called a month and a half or two before, and she said, is there a Lee Harvey Oswald there? And the guy said, yeah, just a minute. Lee, you're wanted on the phone. And this guy came to the phone and said, Oswald here. And she said, this is Dr. So-and-so from Tulane University. When I left Washington, D.C. a couple of months ago, I met a friend of yours, Dr. Jose Rivera, and he gave me a message to give to you. And Oswald said, what the heck are you talking about? He said, I don't know any Jose Rivera. And she says, well, he knows you. He gave me your phone number. And Oswald said, how could he give you my phone number? He said, I just moved in. He said, my cousin Elizabeth Murat found this place for me, and I just moved in. And he says, I don't even know the number myself. And she had the number, and it was given to her sometime before by Dr. Jose Rivera. Now, what did that mean? That meant that Oswald was being controlled from the time he left Dallas until he got to New Orleans, and he stayed with his cousins and uncle and so on, the Murats. And his cousin was a member, it turns out, of some very dubious CIA-linked fronts. She lined him up at the boarding house he stayed in, and she had the phone number for the place. And Dr. Jose Rivera knew Oswald would be living there and didn't realize he wasn't already there. And so when the president was murdered, she called both the Secret Service and the FBI, and both sent representatives to see her. And since the JFK Archives Act, Documents Act, and so on, when all these documents that were previously hidden away, were a lot of them were put out in public, there, in those files, but never reported to the Warren Commission, is the testimony of this Tulane professor about this message from Dr. Jose Rivera and the telephone number for Lee Harvey Oswald before Oswald even moved in.
Staggering.
It is so amazing, but what it demonstrates, as I say, Oswald was controlled. He didn't know it, but what he would be doing 2 months down the line was all laid on. And they knew he would be at that boarding house and so on, and they knew that his cousin would take him there, supposedly scouting around looking for places for him. But, you know, there was another link to this. To me, is very, very important. I was working here on our research into the neurosystemic degenerative diseases, and AIDS is one of the most important of these. And one night, my phone rang, and a lady said to me, Dr. Scott? And I said, no, it's not doctor. I said, I'm a professor of medical history. And she said, oh, well, you're the one I want. She said, I would like to get your book about the Skull Valley incident. And I said, all right, you can order that so much, whatever it was. And I said, we only send out prepaid, though. We don't have the facilities to bill people. And she said, all right, I will send you my order. And she said, it's Dr. Elaine DeFreitas. I said, oh, my goodness, Dr. DeFreitas. Now, I knew of Dr. DeFreitas from my research. She was a very, and still is, I guess, a very significant person in the research that led up to the development of the AIDS epidemic, but I don't think she knew that she was working in it. She was working at the Wistar Institute with Dr. Kapowski. And I said, well, in that case, I'll send you a complimentary copy. And she said, oh, no, no. She said, I'll pay you for it. And I said, no, no. I said, give me your address. I'll send it to you. So Dr. Elaine DeFreitas gave me her address, and I sent it off to her. And about a month later, I got another phone call from her, Dr. Elaine DeFreitas. And she said, my goodness, Professor, if I had read a book like this before I did my research, I would have been a lot different. And I said, oh, why? She said, well, when I was doing my research into chronic fatigue syndrome, and she said, I was finding in the blood of the victims a retroviral particle. And she said, I reported this in the literature. And I got a phone call from Dr. Brian Mahi of the Centers for Disease Control, who said to me, Elaine, you can't be right about this. There's no retrovirus in chronic fatigue syndrome. And she said, well, that's what's coming up when I do my testing. And he said, well, there's something wrong. Something wrong. He said, can I send you 30 samples of blood from people we are following? And he said, you test it, and you tell me if you can find retroviral particles in any of it. She said, yes, yeah, send it along. And he said, now, can I send somebody over from our staff to monitor your testing and to follow how you do it, all the protocols and so on? She said, oh, sure, yeah. I'm perfectly confident of what I'm finding. So he said, all right. And she said he sent over 30 samples of blood, and this guy arrived, and she did all this testing over a period of a couple of months, and not one of the 30 blood samples had any trace of retrovirus. And she couldn't figure this out, if these were chronic fatigue people like the ones she had tested. But when she had to report this, Brian Mahi said to her, well, see, Elaine, I told you, there's no such thing. And she said, now, if I had read your book or one like it before I did that testing, I would not have tested that blood without a lot of checking. Because she said, he could have sent me goat's blood, for all I know. And I said, well, he could have. And she said, after reading your book, I suddenly recalled that the people I had tested had this retrovirus, but among the people who were controls, a certain small percentage who weren't sick also had this trace of retrovirus. And she said there wasn't even that particle or small number in the samples he sent over, and that should have been at least that there. And she said he didn't send me human blood, and they certainly wasn't the blood of people with chronic fatigue. And I said, wow. And then, out of the blue, I don't know what made me ask it, but it just seemed to fit. I said, by the way, do you know a Dr. Jose Rivera? She said, oh, yes, very well. She said, that's the guy that Dr. Mahi sent over to monitor me when I was doing the testing.
What a small world.
Wow. So, it certainly is, but it shows how the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes for Health, at a very high, top, key level, there are people who know what's going on and who manipulate in a very sophisticated way at the very highest levels to run the organization. And the rest of the people who are doing all the work and everything else, they're probably as many excellent and good people as there is in any other institution. But the people like Brian Mahi at the top. Now, the guy's still there. But you see, about
Well, Fletcher Prodi had a term for them, and he called them the secret team.
Yeah, the secret team. And Brian Mahe, a few years ago, I guess about 6 years ago now, a doctor on staff at CDC blew the whistle on Brian Mahe and said, look, the United States Congress has given Brian Mahe millions and millions of dollars to study chronic fatigue syndrome, but he's not studying it. He's saying he is, but he's not. And this doctor had called, William Reeves is his name, he had called a press conference and said this in public. So the government had no choice but to appoint an auditor, and sure enough, they found that $4 million given to Brian Mahe, director of the Centers for Disease Control, was missing. $4 million missing. And you know, the guy is still working there, and he's still getting his paycheck, and they don't dare fire him, because he knows far more, and they know that he knows far more than they can risk having out. And anyway, that's the Dr. Mahe that sent Dr. Jose Rivera over to monitor Dr. Elaine de Freitas, and it's the same Dr. Jose Rivera that gave this peculiar message to Lee Harvey Oswald at a boarding house that Lee Harvey Oswald wasn't even registered at until a couple of months after.
Really weird.
Yeah, and very, very interesting, illuminating. It lets you know.
Well, very convincing to people who will follow the leads, will research, do the research. Now, over the past 3 months, my son and I, who works with me on all this research, we started off researching influenza, H5N1, avian flu. And my goodness, what we did not find is amazing. The things that we did find was amazing. We found, for example, that the people that we had identified as being involved in the development of the AIDS cofactors, especially Dr. Shinnok and Dr. Couch and Dr. Koprowski and Dr. Alton Ochsner, these same people are involved in the influenza pandemic scaremongering that's going on. Dr. Couch is still down there at Baylor University, and he's quoted in the New York Times, and he's quoted in Gina Colata's book, Flu, as a world expert on influenza. He was one of the people involved in the development of the AIDS cofactors. And we found literature that ties him to Dr. Shinnok, literature that goes way back before there was AIDS, and when they were working with a goal in mind, and that goal was to find disease agents that could be utilized for population growth control. We found documents signed by him and Dr. Shinnok, for example. And so I phoned him up at Baylor University, College of Medicine, and I was going to tell him who I was and what I was, of his early research I had located and so on, and he wouldn't talk to me. I asked him for certain documents I couldn't get from the archives, and he wouldn't send them to me. He told me through his secretary that I couldn't have them. Now, here's a guy who's supposed to be a real top researcher in influenza with his feet firmly planted in the camp of those who were developing the AIDS epidemic a few years ago. And he's now engaged in this flu epidemic area of expertise, and he's forecasting all these doom and gloom things about H5N1, and he's leaving out of the equation something very, very important, and that is the Mycoplasma fermentans, which when we went to back to the literature on that and studied it more intensively, looking for further evidence of links to influenza, we found in one of the documents by Dr. Shai-Ching Lo, the top researcher in the U.S. government, that the Mycoplasma fermentans, in its most serious illness of human beings, presents as a flu-like illness. And it rapidly progresses to a illness of high morbidity and very dangerous. And I thought to myself, what's going to happen if a whole bunch of people start becoming ill with the flu, or with a flu-like illness, and they go to the doctors who have never been told anything about the mycoplasma and the flu-like illness that it can cause, and these people who are ill go to the doctor, and he checks out these symptoms, he says, oh my goodness, you've got the flu. What are they going to think? They're going to think that they've got this avian flu, H5N1, that has jumped species from birds to humans and then spread from one human to another human. Now, this sounds so fantastic and so hard to believe. But I ask people to think. Prior to 1981, there was no reference anywhere to a disease called AIDS. And then in 1981, there was a paper published by a Dr. Gottlieb down in California where he identified the first cases of white people in California with AIDS. And today, 8,000 people a day are dying of AIDS, and the world doesn't pay the least bit of attention. Oh, they pay a little bit. They pay a little bit. They go to a conference, and they say, oh, my, isn't that tragic? And they show pictures of AIDS orphans and say, isn't that sad? And they have Stephen Lewis roaming around the country getting everybody to break down and cry about the tragedy of it all. But there's still 8,000 people a day dying of AIDS. And the world is living with it. What is being built up here with this influenza pandemic? Look at the literature, look at the newspapers, listen to the radio and television. Hardly a day will go by you don't hear something about avian flu, H5N1. And what are they preparing the world for? And how much will the population allow to go on before they demand far more serious response by their government? For example, the government of Canada participated totally with the United States back in the 50s and 60s when they were developing the mycoplasma as a disease agent. I've told your listeners before how the government of the U.S. asked the government of Canada to breed 100 million mosquitoes a month. And the government of Canada said, yes, we will. And they went to Belleville, Ontario, Canada, and they adapted the Dominion Parasite Laboratory to become a breeding place for mosquitoes. And they bred 100 million mosquitoes a month in Belleville, Ontario, Canada. The building's still there. And then every month they sent these 100 million mosquitoes to Queen's University. Queen's University, that's supposed to be an institution of honor and dignity and science and progress and something for Canadians to be proud of. But they sent these 100 million mosquitoes every month to Queen's University, where Dr. Reed, head of biology, contaminated the mosquitoes with new disease agents being provided to him by the U.S. researchers. Then when he had these mosquitoes contaminated, he delivered them to the Canadian military. These people who are always bleating about they need better arms for the defense of Canada, as if Greenland was going to invade us tomorrow. And he delivered these infected mosquitoes to the Canadian military, who shared them with the American military, and they would go to various communities in Canada and the United States, and they would let these mosquitoes out by various means. We've got documents showing what kind of means they used, and fortunately, all of this is on record. Because when the Canadian military was doing this, they provided a copy of what they were doing to the Research Council in Ottawa, and most of those people didn't have a clue as to what was going on. They filed it. And then after Watergate, when everybody in the United States was investigating everybody else, Richard Helms of the CIA said to his chief, Sidney Gottlieb, "Hey, gather up all those documents about this mosquito contamination and putting it out into the populations of Canada and the U.S. and destroy all the literature." And they did the best they could on that. But nobody thought to tell the Canada Research Council. And all those documents are still on file in Ottawa at the Canada Research Council. And so this is not a matter of a conspiracy theory. This is an absolute and total fact, backed up by all kinds of documentation. The government of Canada, at a certain level, bred mosquitoes for the U.S. government and got Queen's University to contaminate them and put them out among people in various communities to test to see whether these disease agents would indeed make people ill, even unto death, and if so, how many. Now that is fact, not fiction. It's fact, not theory. And yet here we are drifting along, electing governments, and Mr. Harper saying we will increase the budget of the military by $1 billion-something to secure Canada's defense. Defense against what? Our biggest enemy is the United States of America. And our own military cannot be trusted. I can refer you to a wonderful lady in the Canadian military who served in Saudi Arabia during the first Gulf War, Captain Louise Richard of Ottawa. May God bless her and keep her. She's a wonderful person. And she joined the Canadian military because her father was a general in the Canadian Army and her uncle was a general, and military was in her blood. And she went over to Saudi Arabia and she became infected with Gulf War illnesses. She was tested, and she's infected with 3 different mycoplasmas. Where did they come from? And she's desperately ill. And the government of Canada is using her terribly. All this stuff about honoring veterans, that's such a bunch of baloney. When the push comes to shove, as it were, she was told, this marvelous Canadian, this great patriot, Captain Louise Richard, she was told if she wanted treatment for this mycoplasma infection, she'd have to pay for it herself. And this is all part of this whole picture, and influenza, which we have demonstrated in the latest issue of our journal, which is going in the mail this weekend, and you've got an advanced copy of our proofs. We have to be very, very cautious about these vaccines they're talking about having an emergency supply. and pumping into cadets. Now, I know it sounds unbelievable, and yet back in 1980, when nobody had ever heard the word AIDS, would somebody have thought that 25 years later, 8,000 people a day would be dying of it? What if 25 years from now, 8,000 people a day are dying of influenza? And when you read the documentation about the mycoplasma, which is patented by the United States government, it's patented. And it says that it produces a fatal flu-like illness. And they can blame it on the birds, and people will soak this in from their evening news, and then they'll go out and vote the same old way they always voted, and live with the consequences.
So do you think that the...
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Oh, okay. Can you hear me a little better now?
That's better, yeah.
Do you think that the H5N1 is manufactured, or the panic is just manufactured to get people to take vaccines and stuff?
The H5N1 is a very genuine biological virus. That H stands for hemoglobin hemagglutinin, and the N stands for neuraminidase. And we have studied both, and we know how they work as kind of codes to get into certain kinds of cells. But the thing is, it's a virus of birds, and it's not been known to leap to humans. And any human who ever's had it has never been able to communicate it to other humans around him. And yet all of this drum beating, there's something very, very suspicious about it. And I am so cautious now, after reading the literature and seeing Dr. Reed of Queen's University involved in the creation of a deadly disease agent. I'm not a cynic. I'm a realist. And I study the science of it. Now, there is an H5, hemagglutinin number 5, and a neuraminidase number 1 in birds. And it is viral-based. But you see, it doesn't kill people. It kills other birds. And why they're so worried about a leaping species, they're preparing the world public for something which will be like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And they will say, well, we told you it was apt to happen, and now it's happening. The truth about what is at work, which is a mycoplasma, will not be known. Now, key point, you can go to a bookstore, or any of your listeners can go to a bookstore tomorrow, and ask for a Johns Hopkins University medical desk reference. It's about 1,700 pages thick. And they can turn to the index of that 1,700-page book, which is stated on the cover, and we reproduce the cover in our copy of the journal you've got there. It says, America's number one health authority. But turn to the index, and nowhere will you see the word mycoplasma. And yet it was a mycoplasma that all of these people were working on, and that Dr. Couch, the expert on flu, made his name in mycoplasmas 25 years ago. Why is it not in the Johns Hopkins Medical Guide? Why is there not a single reference to the mycoplasma? Well, as we say in the copy of the journal you have, it's an example of what George Orwell called the memory hole. Anything you don't want the person on the street to know, you get it out of all literature that you can get it out of. And if you go back in your memory and try to remember ever having seen in any of these drum-beating, worrisome reports about avian flu and H5N1 and all of that stuff, did you ever hear once the word mycoplasma mentioned? No. And you won't see it. And the average doctor won't even be able to tell you about it. They'll tell you, well, we've heard a little bit about it. We know there's a mycoplasma called a mycoplasma pneumoniae, but it just causes a very mild kind of pneumonia, and people get over it very quickly. Well, that's what they tell the doctors. And unfortunately, so many of the doctors, in fact, most of them, are participants in this dumbing down of humanity about the reality of health and disease. I can give you one example. Multiple sclerosis. There's a very large element demonstrated by various tests that people with multiple sclerosis have a mycoplasmal infection. And that the mycoplasma, well, we won't go into the details of that. A gentleman in Hamilton, Ontario, 2.5 years ago, I was in Hamilton to speak at a public meeting, and he asked the person who was organizing it if he could meet with me privately, and I said, yeah, I'll do that after the meeting. And after the meeting, I met with this person who looked a picture of health. He was about 45, 46 years old. He was a school teacher on a disability pension because 12 years before he had been in a wheelchair with multiple sclerosis. And he had gone to a Dr. Williams in Scarborough, Ontario. And Dr. Williams had said to him, I don't think you have multiple sclerosis. You have all the same symptoms and all the rest of it. But I believe you have what we would call cerebral brucellosis. Now, you need to know that the DNA of the bacteria Brucella is identical in a large part to the DNA of the mycoplasma. And so Dr. Williams said, I'm going to treat you for cerebral brucellosis rather than multiple sclerosis and the amantadine and the other stuff they give them. And he started giving him, I believe it was tetracycline or doxycycline, one of those. The guy began to recover. And within a year, he was out of the wheelchair. And within another year, he was totally active. And he's been active ever since. He plays golf. He swims. He plays volleyball. He does all of these things. He's a perfectly healthy guy. So I phoned up, or I said to the lady who organized the meeting, I said, would you get Dr. Williams' office for me? This was the next day. And she said yes, and she called the Dr. Williams' office. He had moved to Toronto from Scarborough, and spoke to his secretary and said, I wanted to talk to Dr. Williams about cerebral brucellosis and the mycoplasma and multiple sclerosis, and Dr. Williams wouldn't talk with me. And the lady, his receptionist, said that when Dr. Williams had reported how this person with apparent multiple sclerosis had recovered with an antibiotic named doxycycline or tetracycline, one of that group, the Ontario College of Physicians and Surgeons reprimanded Dr. Williams. They said, this is not an approved protocol in Ontario. And if you persist in treating people with multiple sclerosis with this antibiotic, you will be subject to discipline by the college. And so Dr. Williams stopped treating people in this way and refused to talk with me about it because he didn't want to lose his license and he wanted to keep practicing medicine, even though he wasn't allowed to do what science pointed at being a reasonable response to a mycoplasmal infection.
Boy, you have to wonder how many cases like that happen that we don't hear about.
Well, look at Dr. Kropp in Toronto. Thousands of patients swear by the fellow. And yet the College of Physicians and Surgeons has made his life totally miserable. And I'm pleased to say that Dr. Kropp sent in $25 and became a member of our Common Cause Medical Research Foundation. Now, we haven't heard from him for about 3 or 4 years, but the very fact that he joined our foundation was, to us, an important plus. And, you know, there in Vancouver, unfortunately, at a distance of a couple of thousand miles, it's very hard to help people. And there was a lady in Vancouver had applied for Canada Pension Plan about 4 years ago. And she sent me her documents because she had chronic fatigue syndrome. And the Canada Pension Board had told her, no, that's not a disease, it's all in your head. And she sent me her medical records, and I went over them, and I pointed out to them a mycoplasmal infection and how the mycoplasma worked and how it damaged her cells and so on. And she went before the board, and they turned her down again. And they said to her, you're able to work. You're ill in the head. You know, go back to work. And about 3 months later, she died. Now, that just tells you how much these boards know about what they're looking at. And her name was, just get the file out, Alice Clark. She was turned down by the Canada Pension Board in Vancouver, told that she was healthy enough to go back to work, and she dies. And I've got the names of the doctors in Vancouver who tried to tell her that there's no such thing as chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yeah, well, tell that to the people suffering from it.
Hey, pardon?
You can't tell that to the people suffering from it.
Yes, indeed. Isn't it awful?
You know, Professor, the subject is very interesting to me, in particular, because, and I've mentioned this to you before, I've had a lot of problems in my life with fibromyalgia since I was a young kid, terrible migraines and endometriosis. My brother has severe multiple chemical sensitivity. And I started taking last Christmas a plant called cat's claw in a fairly large amount. It cleared up all of that stuff. And I noticed when I looked at the compounds in it, that tetracycline compound is one of the active things in this plant. And it's an antiviral. It has a lot of properties, anti-tumor, anti-cancer. So I might just want to, you know, draw your attention to that one. If you run into doctors who are having a problem with prescribing an antibiotic, they might want to try that plant instead.
Well, that certainly is an interesting lead, and I'm going to make an immediate note of it. I know of cat's paw, is it?
Cat's claw, C-L-A-W.
Yeah, but I've never had an occasion, really, to look into that because, as I say, our research has been limited to the published, official, scientifically peer-reviewed documentation. Because we don't want people to say, well, you know, anybody can say that. We want to be able to refer them to JAMA or to the New England Journal of Medicine or the Journal of the Canadian Medical Association and such a volume, such and such a day, you know, and let them read the evidence for themselves. And but I certainly will take a second look at Cat's Claw because we're working on the next issue of the journal, which will be coming out in June the 1st.
Well, there's some very credible research published about cat's claw online, so I'm surprised that it isn't a little more noticed. But I would have to say from what I've seen from it, really, like, we're talking about 5 grams a day for an adult. And I'll tell you, it killed all, I had warts on my foot. It killed them all. It just,
great.
Like, totally cleaned me out. So I just have to promote. And I also have to thank you, because last time you were on, there was one issue that didn't clear up, and that I was having terrible burning problems with my arms and legs. And you suggested very high doses of vitamin C.
Yes.
And between that and a chiropractor, the problem's minuscule by comparison now. It's in my life. I mean, to tell you, it was looking pretty bleak at 40 years old and not being able to find a position to put your arms in because they get these raging, burning pains.
Yeah.
And so thank you very much for that suggestion. Really.
We have certainly found that vitamin C is an absolutely essential supplement to any diet people, follow. A normal diet, at least 1 gram with every meal, and preferably 2 grams with every meal. And let me give you another example from multiple sclerosis. A lady outside of Sudbury here in a little village called Chelmsford, she got in touch with me about 6 months ago, and she said, Professor Scott, I have multiple sclerosis. I am in a wheelchair. I can't get out of the wheelchair for more than minutes at a time, and so on. And she says, I want you to help me, if you will. And I said, well, I'm not a medical doctor, and I can't diagnose, and I can't prescribe. She says, no, but I know from certain people what they've done after they've chatted with you. And I said, well, okay, write me a 2 or 3 page letter about when you became ill, what the symptoms were, what the diagnosis was, what the treatment was, and let me get back to you. So a week and a half later, I got a letter from her, and she gave me these details. And one of the details she mentioned was that she had a rash on her back and had had it for 12 years. As a kind of a side symptom to the multiple sclerosis. And her doctor wasn't able to do anything about it. They had tried all kinds of stuff. So I said, well, okay, let's start with that. Go to the drugstore, and a non-prescription drug, Uramol, it's made of urea. And it's purified and made into a lotion, and rub that on your back. So she went and got a bottle of it, put it on her back one night. Next day, the rash, after 12 years, totally gone, and hasn't been back since. Now, we know why the urea works. We know that. And
people have to read your book, that book Life, because it does explain very clearly the connections are made about the role of urea in deactivating the mycoplasma and turning it into a crystal.
Yes, it's so amazing. And then, then I said, now what's your next problem? She said, double vision. She said, I have to wear these glasses. She said, because without them, I see everything twice over, and it's so upsetting. But so I said, okay, go to the drugstore, non-prescription drug, called Vasicon A, VASOCONA, and buy a bottle of it for about $11, put a drop in each eye every second day. And she went and did that, and about a week later she got in touch with me and she said, you know, the double vision's gone. And a couple weeks later she said, I've been able to put aside my glasses, I don't need them anymore. And what's next? So I said, well, go to your doctor and ask him to prescribe, I think it was doxycycline. And she said she went to the doctor, and I told her, don't tell her that you've been diagnosed and I'm prescribing. And she went to the doctor, and he said, my, what are you doing? You're more mobile. Your rash is gone. Your double vision is gone. And she said, she told him about what I had suggested and who I was. And he had checked out on his website, blah, 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 some of the material that's available, pro and con, the work we're doing. And he agreed to prescribe for her one of the tetracycline family. I forget which one it is. And she gets this in tablet form daily. And she has been improving. Now, every week I get her to send me a letter which summarizes her condition. And she says here, for example, I have all day energy, although my eyes are jumping later on in the day. And then Sunday, the November 27th, I did a lot today and I still feel fine. I'm out of the wheelchair good part of the day. And November 28th, energy again today. But I did have to relax. My heart felt tired and so on. But anyway, she gives me these reports. And obviously, she's improving. But this is a doctor's prescription she's got. And he was kind of unhappy about prescribing it. But he's at least a decent sort of doctor and wanted to give it a try. And she's now out of her wheelchair much more than she ever was before, and she's doing it on the basis of remedies aside from the doxycycline, which are readily available on over-the-counter drugs at a drugstore. And yet here's the Multiple Sclerosis Society. They don't seem to know anything about this. In fact, we learned about 2 months ago that the Multiple Sclerosis Society in Toronto had sent an email to a number of their members warning them against the Common Cause Medical Research Foundation and said that all we were in it for was the money. And they wouldn't send me a copy of the email. And a lady like this, we... No mention of charge ever. It's all done because we just give them the research we have been doing, and it's anecdotal research. We find people who are ill and who are willing to try natural remedies, and they have an altered health picture, and we share that with other people. And here the Multiple Sclerosis Society is choosing to badmouth us without ever being in touch with us about how is it you're able to have people who have rashes cure and double vision cure. They don't do that. They circulate documentation putting down the work we're doing.
Yeah, well, it's amazing that you'd think that a foundation such as that would have the interests of its members at heart. It makes you wonder about who's in control of the thing.
Very much so, yes.
Or along with the JFK assassination, every time it's around November 22nd, they bring out somebody like Gary Mack to go on TV to just put people back to sleep.
Yeah.
And say, don't worry, Lee Oswald did it after all.
Yeah. Isn't it amazing? They just have to give them that kind of booster shot, don't they?
Yeah. So I don't know if there's much more to bring up. Is there anything that we haven't discussed? Do you have any conferences coming up? Anything you'd like to
add? Well, the next conference is in Sudbury in August 2006. And it is being advertised in the journal. Now, the special issue of the journal, you've got the galley proofs there, but anyway, the special journal on influenza, people need to read it, and they can get a copy. Can I give my address?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Okay, people can get a copy by sending $15 check or money order to CCMRF, which means Common Cause Medical Research Foundation, CCMRF, Box 133, Station B, as in Bob, Sudbury, P as in Peter, 3, E as in Edward, 4, N as in Norman, 5. Send $15 and ask for the journal on influenza, and an awful lot of your questions about H5N1 and avian flu and G jumping species and all of this hocus pocus will be laid out for you in it. So you can read it and think about it and share it with fellow Canadians and hopefully be better informed. Well, tragically, they didn't have much choice. Better informed than all those poor people of Africa and third world countries who held out their arm and let the United States government shoot a smallpox vaccine into them, which did indeed stop smallpox. No gainsaying that. But the smallpox vaccine had been contaminated by a mycoplasma and a retroviral combination that produces AIDS. And it's showing now with 8,000 people a day dying. What is the vaccine they're talking about for influenza? Now, I haven't taken a vaccination for over 40 years, and I don't intend to take one. And I'm 81 years old, and I like to work every day and study because I feel like it. I feel healthy enough to work daily. But the people I see who go and get these vaccines because they're drumbeat into it and then are ill, they say, I was never the same after I had my flu shot. And recently on CBC Radio here in Sudbury, Dr. Brian Goldman was their guest. He's their health counselor on their program. And the host of the show, Marcus Schwabe, said to him, well, Dr. Goldman, we haven't seen you for a couple of weeks. Where have you been? And Dr. Goldman said, well, I was off ill. I had the flu. And Marcus said, what? You had the flu? Didn't you have your flu shot? You were telling our listeners to get the flu shot. He says, yes, I and all our office went down and got our flu shot. And I got the worst case of flu I ever got in my life. Now imagine a medical doctor counseling thousands of people to get a flu shot, and when he gets it, he gets the worst case of flu he ever got in his life. What is in store for us in the face of this avian flu drum beating? This H5N1 stuff. And why don't they mention mycoplasma? We've got all the documents demonstrating its dangers and its ramifications, and yet the average doctor can't tell you anything about it. But if people would like to order our special issue on influenza, then send us the $15 or send $25 for a year's membership, which includes a subscription to the journal.
And also you have still available the Life book, which I'd highly recommend people get. How much is that one again?
I forget. I don't really do the business part of it. My son handles all that part. But I'm not sure. Oh, wait, maybe I can check a...
You know what
book.
I should do? I should get your son's phone number after the show, and I'll connect with him and get all the prices and put this on the website.
Okay, now, in the copy of the journal that you have there, there is a book page, and it lists Life... Oh, yes, here it is here. Canadian, it's $33.80. $33.80.
Okay, then. Okay.
And that's the same address as before.
All right. Well, then I guess we've had you probably just about an hour and a half. Not quite sure what time it is, but if there's nothing else that you'd like to add for the moment, then maybe we'll just call it a night and bring you back when we have another update.
Well, it's nice to chat with you and to share with your listeners what we're learning. And as I mentioned to you in an earlier show, I'm not a medical doctor. I have a Master of Science degree from Guelph University, and I didn't begin studying these diseases until 10 years ago, in 1995. And in that 10 years, honest, careful research, looking very carefully at all the important details, the picture emerges very, very clearly that health is one of the instruments of social control, and that people who just blindly put their faith in quote-unquote the medical world or the medical professionals are offering themselves as hostages to a fate they may not want to experience. And I appreciate the chance of chatting with you, and our next issue of the journal, we're already working on it, and it will be well worth having.
Yeah, they all are. We really appreciate your time with us. We look forward to next time we'll have you on. And, of course, you have our support. We're letting people know that we've been reading your work, and it's all very good. So,
well, thank you very much.
Yeah, you know, it's actually one of a kind, because going up against anything like the medical community or what you're doing is just uncovering what's already there.
Yes, and it's right out in the open. It's what they say, hidden in plain sight. And, you know, it's very interesting, just in passing, let me put this in. Over the past few years, I received phone calls from people like Dr. Elaine DeFreitas and others. And among the people who phoned me were two people, both of whom had been nominated at one point or another for the Nobel Prize in Medicine. Dr. Hugh Feudenberg was nominated for the Nobel Prize, and Dr. Garth Nicholson was nominated for the Nobel Prize. And both of them had somehow learned of some of our research. Both of them phoned me out of the blue and said, my goodness, you know, this is amazing material here. And they went on, especially in the case of Garth Nicholson, he went on to become a very good friend of ours and very supportive of the research that we've done. In fact, he has himself now produced a book called Project Daylily about the Gulf War illnesses that we spoke about and the role of the mycoplasma. But he puts it in the form of a novel, so people can take the book and relax by a fireplace and read it and unwittingly get a whole lot of really important scientific information. But it's great talking with you, and have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Yes.
And same to all your listeners, and call anytime.
All right, well, thanks so much. Very interesting, and we're looking forward to have you on again. Possibly for your next issue, but do call me as well.
Okay, well, thanks, Lynn and Anita. Great talking to you.
You too. Thanks a lot.
Right, bye.
Okay, this has been show number 251, Black Op Radio, and it is, December 15th, I think.
It is. Getting close to Christmas again.
Right.
Zinging by.
All right, well, we'll see you next week.
All right. Good night, everybody.
You've been listening to Black Op Radio, broadcasting weekly from the Fiasco Brothers Recording Studio in Vancouver, Canada. You're listening to the Fiasco Brothers Radio Network.